Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Trout fishing in America isn't just the name of a once popular book by Richard Brautigan. It's a sport, a hobby, a lifestyle, and a passion for many. Trout are a member of the salmonid family, which include whitefish, graylings, and of course, salmon, along with a variety of trout species, including rainbow, brown, brook, cutthroat, lake, golden, and bull trout, and probably others I don't even know about. All of the salmonids spawn in fresh water, but some are anadromous fish that spend much of their lives in the ocean while returning to freshwater rivers and streams to spawn. For salmon, this is the end of their life cycle, but there is a variety of trout, the steelhead, that can live in the ocean and return to their native spawning streams repeatedly. Trout, salmon, and steelhead are also indicators of the health of an aquatic ecosystem. Most trout need cold, clean, oxygenated water to survive, and currently that water is imperiled by drought and wildfires fueled by climate change. In this show, we'll talk to Curtis Knight, the executive director of Caltrout, and Kristen Rivard, the director of Trout Unlimited in Oregon, about how those advocacy groups are working to protect the waters that are the home to the fish that many love to fish for. And speaking of fishing, later on in the show, we'll visit with the director of fishing guides for the Fly Shop in Redding, California, which is the home base for some of the best fly fishing waters in the West. We'll find out why you don't have to look like Brad Pitt in A River Runs Through It to enjoy the art, science, and fun of fly fishing. Our first guest is Curtis Knight, executive director for Caltrout. He joined us recently from his home near Mount Shasta in Northern California. Curtis, welcome to Blue Dot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'd like to start out by giving people an overview about what Caltrout is. It's 50 years old. Can you tell us about, you know, how was this organization born?
Right. Hard to reach a 50-year milestone for a nonprofit statewide organization. So we're really proud of all the achievements that we've had in the past 50 years. And we started really from pretty humble beginnings, a group of mainly anglers were concerned about declining water conditions, river health, even back in the late 60s, early 70s. And they rallied together to do a couple projects. Hat Creek was one of our first projects in the early 70s that was completed. They went to Sacramento and demanded more progressive fishing regulations. And from there, they started to take off. And really, we've evolved a lot over the past 50 years. And really, in the last decade, it's been water, 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 focused on water, with the emphasis that if we have healthy waters, we're going to have healthy fish. And that's going to mean healthy rivers. And that's going to be better for all Californians.
Yeah. And let's talk about that a little bit, because right now, your region, our region, California, here where I live and you live, is going through this massive drought that's been going on for the better part of, you know, going on two decades, really, now, if you look at it, you really objectively look at the rainfall totals for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
We've been locked into a drought for quite a while, and this year's been the most severe of all. How is this affecting the waters that the trout need, the cold water that the trout need to survive?
Yeah, you particularly see the impact on those species that are on the edge already. So Southern California steelhead, for example, there are still steelhead, these big ocean-going fish that come out of the ocean and spawn in streams as far down as San Diego, and they're still there. They're still kicking around. They're still doing their thing. They're extremely resilient. But in dry years, some of those rivers never even flow. So they'll wait an entire year out in the ocean to enter that stream to go spawn, and the water just won't come. So it definitely impacts species like that. And you can, you know, another good example of is more in area where I live, near Mount Shasta, on the high slopes of Mount Shasta, headwaters of the McLeod River, there's a native red band trout that's a sort of above all the big falls. If you're familiar with the falls on the McLeod, it's a separate from the rainbow trout that's down below, and it lives in these small spring-fed streams that come out of the ground and travel for sometimes just a couple miles and then disappear back into the volcanic soil, not really even connected to the main stem of the McLeod, with surface water. And these fish have been there for thousands of years in these small little habitats. And some of these streams started to dry up, and that's starting to impact some of these species that are already sort of on the edge.
And your organization uses, you know, sound science to do its work. Tell us a little bit about your partnership with UC Davis.
Yeah, it goes back 10, 15 years ago. We ramped up our involvement with UC Davis and to really put science and information and data gathering right at the point, tip of the spear of what we do. So we need to lead with research and information to be able to know what's priority to restore, dams priority to remove, what policy is the right one to advocate for in Sacramento, for example. So that we really put that first. And UC Davis has been our primary partner with that. One of the big things we did with them was a status of the salmonage report. We did this in 2008. We did it again in 2017, and we came up with some metrics about how the health of our native trout, steelhead, and salmon are doing. And in 2017, we found that in 100 years, we could lose half of our native trout, steelhead, and salmon. And that was sort of a wake-up call for us. In the next 50 years, it could even happen. So it was a wake-up call for us that we've been around for 50 years, but in the next 50 years, we could lose roughly half of what we have now, if current trends continue. So I think that really has lit a fire under us over the last several years to increase the impact that we can have, to increase the scale and size of our projects, to try to make change happen faster. And, you know, we find some encouragement in that when you think about the 32 different kinds of trout, steelhead, and salmon we have in the state, it's remarkable. It's the highest diversity in the lower 48. We've only lost one. So we still have 31. So given all the impacts, everything we've done to our fish and our waterways here in California, it's amazing how resilient they are and how responsive they are to some of the change that we're talking about.
Yeah. And that one is the bull trout?
Yep, and that's the bull trout, and another great example of a species on the edge. It was the southernmost distribution of bull trout. They're a glacial-loving fish. They like cold, cold water. They're a char, and they existed in the McLeod, and the thought is that they, as glaciers receded thousands of years ago, that they hung on the flanks of Shasta because of the really cold water coming out of the springs that feed the McLeod, 41 degrees. It's about as cold as you can find in a lot of it. And they persisted there. But Shasta Dam and ultimately McLeod Dam sort of were the 1-2 punch to knock them out of California.
Mm. Well, one of the things that your organization does is a program called Protect the Best. Could you tell us about that? And specifically, what are the best places in California in terms of trout? What are the special places?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And Protect the Best for us is just the place to start. It's so much easier to protect a place than to restore it. And so I think one of the best examples of this is the Smith River. It's our largest undammed river right near the Oregon border there and far northwestern California. Anybody who's driven along the Smith sees it as one of the most beautiful rivers we have too. And they still have a good robust fish runs in most years that do come into there. And we had an example of what we would do on this Protect the Best is there was a threat of a nickel mine going in the headwaters of the Smith. And that's something that we and many others rose up and challenged really challenged whether that was a good idea and whether it was legal to go forward and put a exploratory nickel mine in the headwaters of the Smith River. Congressman Huffman over there, that's his jurisdiction, played a lead role in helping push that back too. So I wouldn't say that thing is dead and gone, but it's certainly been put on the back burner thanks to efforts of a lot of folks.
Yeah, and so can you kind of run through what are the best places in California, the key places that you've been protecting?
Yeah, well, that's the Smith River, certainly one of them. We have a lot of activity in the Eel River over on the coast. It's our third largest watershed behind the Sacramento and the Klamath. Remarkable potential for fish abundance. You see it in some years, but estuary improvement, removing barriers to tributaries on tributary streams to the Eel. We have a big push right now to remove Scott Dam at the headwaters of the Eel River, which would open up hundreds of miles of habitat for steelhead and salmon, and not just any habitat. It's a 5,000 foot range in the coast range up by Snow Mountain, and that area is where the headwaters come from the Eel. That's highly valuable habitat, especially in the face of climate change, getting fish up into those cold water areas. We also, you know, as far as protect the best too, you know, those are kind of steelhead waters that are over there on the coast. But trout fishing, I think everybody, if you're in California, you think about the McLeod River, you think about Pitt River, Hat, Fall, these areas that are here in the North State. We do a lot of work on the Fall River, for example, doing some radio tracking of fish there, better understanding where those fish, those unique fish in that huge Spring Creek are spawning, what they're doing. We're finding some interesting information there where there may be two different strains of fish that are behaving different, spawning in different areas at different times. So that's pretty interesting. And also mammoth. I think if you're in Southern California, heading over to Mammoth and fishing the Owens and Hot Creek, where we've had a long history of working with LADWP, actually suing LADWP back in the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power back in the 80s and winning a historic lawsuit against them to restore flows back in the Mono Lake. Rush Creek and many of these tributary streams are great places to go fish as well. So when I think about trout fishing and I think about protecting the best, I think a lot about the Mammoth area and the Shasta area.
Yeah. Well, you know, what role do fly fishermen play in protecting habitat?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think as far as percentage wise, I think it's, you know, probably the majority of our supporters are anglers, and the majority of those are probably fly anglers, although we have seen a lot of growth in our membership and supporters just coming from people that appreciate cold, clean water and healthy rivers. And that's something that is really central to the work that we do. So it's nice to see that. I think we all have a role to play there. I think one of the interesting things that I've seen with folks that have gotten more involved or just interested is maybe somebody starts to fish or appreciate these rivers first later in life, or just these things that catch their eye about a river and they just want to know a little bit more. So maybe they like to go fish in a place, and maybe they like to go fish in the McLeod, and they then start to better understand, well, what makes this place so beautiful? Where does this water come from? And where does it go after it goes through here? And starting to better understand how California's water flows, how it's used, where it originates, I think gives everybody a deeper appreciation and better understanding of what each of us individually can do to help protect this resource for future generations.
Thank you so much, Curtis, for joining us.
Yeah, Dave, thanks for having me. We really appreciate it.
Thanks to our guest, Curtis Knight, the executive director of Caltrout. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our show all about trout on Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Kristen Rivard. She's the director of Trout Unlimited in Oregon, and she joins us to talk about some of the challenges fisheries are facing, especially in southern Oregon, which has been hard hit by drought and wildfire. Kristen Rivard, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us just a little bit overall about the organization you work for, Trout Unlimited? What is the role of Trout Unlimited, and what are its major goals?
So the mission of Trout Unlimited is to conserve coldwater fisheries across the United States. There's value in that both for the opportunity for anglers to get out on the river and fish, as well as for the values that are associated with these coldwater fisheries, water quality, aesthetics, drinking water source areas, and healthy watersheds as well in terms of forestry and how we utilize the resources within a watershed. So Trout Unlimited endeavors to engage with both restoration activities on the ground to restore and improve these places, as well as policy debates designed to protect and preserve some of these spaces or support good management of them.
Yeah, and when you talk about cold water fisheries, the salmonid family, that salmon, trout, where your name comes from, and some people aren't aware that they're all under the same umbrella biologically. Those fish really are kind of a canary in the coal mine as far as environmental health, aren't they?
Absolutely. Fish depend on all types of things within the river system that are important for humans and overall ecological function. Things like the quality of water, which includes the temperature of the water, as well as whether or not you have nutrient loading conditions that can create algal blooms and sometimes toxic algal blooms. So all of the things that fish need to persist and thrive are indicators of healthy ecosystems. And I would add to that the food that fish depend on in terms of macroinvertebrates and, just the entirety of the food web.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned algal blooms, because just down the street from me, a neighbor for many years has had a pond with bass in it. Not a cold water fish, but a nice pond with bass. And because of the major heat waves and the drought here in Northern California, they had a huge algal bloom that just choked off the oxygen in that pond, and there were dead fish everywhere. It was just tragic, and they had to drain the entire pond.
Absolutely, and we see those in our natural systems as well. I think one of the best examples of that is the upper part of the Klamath Basin. Upper Klamath Lake, one of the largest freshwater lakes in the United States, historically was what's called eutrophic, meaning it's very productive. It has lots of algal communities and, green things growing in the lake, which is why it's so productive and provides so much food for the fish in the system. But all of the changes that have happened in the watershed in terms of diking and draining of wetlands, poor forest management, having cattle grazing into the streams that feed into the lake, have led to too much phosphorus in the lake, which has spurred a series of changes in the algal communities and led to these huge monoculture algal blooms. And as you just described, when those crash, there's virtually no oxygen left in the lake, and so you end up with huge fish kills. In addition, on the heels of those blooms, we get secondary blooms in that system, which are toxic algal species and are neurotoxins. So you'll see notices posted around the lake, "Don't let your dog swim here," because literally it can kill the animal. And certainly you don't want to have human contact with the lake during those periods of time. So you can take a system that was naturally had healthy algal communities and push it to a brink where it's unsustainable and, creates really horrific conditions for fish and wildlife.
Yeah, well, let's talk a bit more about that Klamath Lake, Klamath Basin region, because it's been much in the news lately. And I don't think it would be overstating it to say that there's a water war going on there. Could you comment on, from your perspective, what's going on there with all of these various factions and wells drying up and, the demands for more water and, how fish fit into all this?
Yeah, no, it certainly is in a sense a water war, although the conditions we've faced this year have really been that there's so little water that there really isn't water to fight over for anyone. In the basin, you know, simply water is over-appropriated. Too much water has been promised to too many people for too many different reasons. So you have a situation of extensive agricultural demand. And I'll point out that a lot of that demand is from small family farms. A lot of it's organic production, all the kinds of things that, you know, we think about for healthy, sustainable food supplies. For the most part, the farming and ranching communities in the Klamath represent that type of food system. But we also have, you know, four federally recognized tribes on the river and in that system. And we made treaty commitments to those tribes to sustain their hunting, fishing, and gathering rights. And as we face climate change and increased drought conditions, the legacy of poor forest management, we just see really a collision of the commitments that have been made to those different communities, as well as just to, you know, generally healthy rivers that should have free-flowing clean water in them and healthy fisheries. And so we reach a place where there just isn't enough water to fulfill all of those demands. And you start having to think about how we make fairly radical shifts to management of that system and still support, you know, reasonable economic opportunity for those communities while creating a space that we can recover our fisheries. In the Klamath, there's a number of species of fish that are nearing extinction and, you know, without dramatic change are likely to go extinct in my lifetime, at least.
Oh. What about the other end of the Klamath River where it flows into the Pacific Ocean? What are some of the environmental issues going on there?
Well, what you see at the bottom end of the river is, you know, the result of all of the things that happen higher up in the system. The Klamath is often referred to as an upside down basin because you have most of the heavy use of the watershed and the water occurring in the upper part of the basin. And the lower part of the basin has a lot of national forest land, tribal reservation lands, and relatively lightly impacted, watershed. But the impact of things like the algal blooms and the poor water quality that we talked about are really challenging lower in the system. We have the impacts of four large hydroelectric dams that prevent migration of anadromous fish to the upper half of the basin. Around 400 stream miles of habitat are cut off from migration because of the dams, which are slated for removal. And then we also have this overallocation of water. So in a year like this, when we weren't able to provide normal heavy spring flows where you have what are called flushing flows, big storm events in the spring running off through the system, we were able to see proliferation of certain things that are negative for the fish. And as a result, we had a massive juvenile fish kill this year in the lower part of the river, which is, you know, devastating because without those baby fish making it, years from now, we're still going to be feeling the impacts of that when those adult fish should have been returning to spawn. So it's a multi-year impact. It's particularly hard on the Yurok tribe, whose homeland is there and whose culture and history are so dependent on those fish.
Yeah, and when you say anadromous fish, you're talking about salmon and steelhead.
That's right, and lamprey.
Mm-hmm. Those are all fish that go to sea and then spawn inland.
Correct.
Well, let's talk some more about like the trout fisheries of Oregon. What are some of the effects going on from all of the wildfire activity in Oregon, and how is that affecting the trout fisheries of Oregon and the mountain regions there? And specifically also, I'd like you to talk about how do places like that recover after a fire, and what kind of work does Trout Unlimited do to foster that?
So Trout Unlimited is mostly engaged in policy discussions around management of the forests. And then we'll also deal with the direct impacts on a particular river system after fires come through. As you suggest, they can be, you know, really catastrophic in terms of what happens to a river that's seeing a huge burn in its watershed. just delivery of sediment, changes to wood recruitment. A lot of times those fires come with pretty significant salvage logging. And so you'll see, you know, a lot of increased road building activity and timber harvest happening, trying to pull those trees out before the value of the wood is completely lost. But the intensity of that activity is much, much greater on the watershed than you would see normally. So, you know, we're involved in both trying to support better forest management across the Western landscape, as well as having mechanisms in place to respond when these catastrophic fires happen. And, you know, certainly they will continue to happen. Another thing to think about, though, is as these populations, you know, struggle and we see less and less distribution of certain fish, bull trout are a great example of that. They're in the upper part of the Klamath and many parts of Oregon, they're ESA listed mostly as threatened. And what's happened is bull trout used to have pretty large migratory areas. And now because of changes in water quality and fish passage, you mostly see them restricted to these really short reaches high up in a watershed. They have a huge amount of thermal dependency. So they need very, very cold water to thrive. And so like we saw with the Bootleg fire this year, 5 of the 7 core populations for bull trout in the upper Klamath persist only in the areas that were completely burned from the fire. So we haven't been able to get in there yet and see, you know, what's happened on the ground in those systems just because they're still in, you know, the forest is still closed and it's too dangerous to access those areas. But, you know, there's a lot of concern when you have a species like that that's so, so close to extirpation or extinction from these areas that, you know, a catastrophic fire like that can really have long-range impacts.
You've mentioned poor forest management, and we hear that constantly when we talk about the multiple causes for these large wildfires. What would you identify as some practices that really need to change to have better forest management?
Well, I think, you know, certainly prescribed management is a huge piece of it. We all understand that decades of really aggressive fire suppression on top of some of the really extensive clear cutting operations that have gone on have led to forests that are just, there's too much underbrush, too many trees, you don't have the range of age and species diversity that you historically would have. And so as a result, instead of seeing, you know, regular ground fires burning through these forests that clean out some of that underbrush, but leave a lot of the mature trees relatively unscathed and healthy, instead we're seeing these absolutely catastrophic fires where everything on the ground is gone and it's just an entirely charred landscape. So we need to get back to more of a healthy balance in our forests, which includes some level of active management, which is, you know, I think is notable, has gone on for a long time.
Before we let you go, could you talk a bit about the role that anglers, especially people that enjoy fly fishing, have played historically and currently with your organization, Trout Unlimited?
Yeah, Trout Unlimited was founded originally by fishermen with kind of the motto, if you take care of the fishing will take care of itself. And that concept that if you really enjoy recreating with a resource, you have a responsibility to steward and maintain that resource and give back to it. And so I think anglers are a really important voice for our rivers, for our river health, and all of the values we associate with rivers.
Yeah. And finally, what do you personally most enjoy about your work with Trout Unlimited?
Oh, my favorite part is getting together with people that have different perspectives on the same issue. Trout Unlimited really tries to serve this pragmatic ground that's not about ideology, but instead about finding balanced, durable solutions. And so my favorite part is sitting down with diverse communities and trying to tackle some of these issues that we face for healthy rivers and healthy fisheries for the future.
Well, Kristen Rivard, thank you so much for spending the time with us, and I really enjoyed your perspectives.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our look at how trout are such a special indicator species for the health of freshwater ecosystems. When we come back, we'll take a look at the art and science of fly fishing. Stay with us.
He began each session with the same instruction. Casting is an art that is performed on a four-count rhythm between 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. If he had had his way, nobody who did not know how to catch a fish would be allowed to disgrace a fish by catching it.
That's a clip from the classic Robert Redford film, A River Runs Through It. And while we can't all have Tom Skerritt's character as our father to teach us how to fly fish, I know someone who can. Our next guest is Brian Quick. Brian is a longtime fly fisherman and the director of outfitters for one of the West's elite fly fishing shops and guide services, the Fly Shop in Redding, California. Brian Quick, welcome to Blue Dot.
Great. Thanks to be here, Dave.
First thing I want to ask you is, you know, fly fishing has got this wonderful, intimidating for some people, mystique about it. What is the allure, if I can use that word, for fly fishing? Why do people love fly fishing so much?
Well, I think that most people may be intimidated at first, but for me, it was about being outside and seeing those beautiful casts and everything. But you also get to be in some of the most beautiful places. And I don't understand why people wouldn't want to just get out there and do it like I did when I was a little kid.
Yeah. And how did you get started in fly fishing?
Well, I believe we were on a camping trip on the Kings River below Pine Flat Reservoir. And pretty much I saw some guys out there catching trout on using fly rods. And so I talked to them a little bit. And then I asked for a fly rod set up for my birthday. And so I got one. And after that, it was pretty much I was lost forever at that point. So.
Do you remember like those first few times when you went out with your new fly rod, you know, learning how to do it? How long did it take you before you like caught your first fish?
Oh, yeah. Well, I can't remember the first fish I caught. It was probably something down at the lake, like a bluegill. But I started going to the library and looking at books, and I didn't really have a mentor that could help me out. So we did our annual camping trips in the Western Sierra. And so I started looking in a lot of the books and figuring out what to tie. And so I tied a few flies and bought a couple. And then the first trout I ever caught was a rainbow on the Kings River on a caddis. And I have to say, it was all by chance because I was wading upstream and I was skating it along the surface during a huge hatch after we'd set up our camp. And it was about a 9-inch rainbow trout. So it was awesome.
Oh yeah, that must have been fun.
Yeah, and after that, it was just figuring out basically what else I had to do in terms of being able to cast further and tie better flies and figuring out when to fish. And I think that what really got me going was meeting a couple of the guys that fished on the Kings River through the club and also through college. And so that's pretty much how I got started figuring out really how to be better at it and enjoying it. So
yeah, it always helps to be around people who are also doing that can help you. So let's talk about like, what's the best way for somebody to get into the sport of fly fishing? If they're really interested and it's like, I want to take this up. You know, I've been a spin fisher all my life, and I've always wanted to try fly fishing. Maybe you got a fly rod for your birthday. What's the best way to get somebody into the sport? Is it to go out with like one of your guides?
Yeah. And of course I work for the fly shop. So that's definitely one way you can get out and see if you like it. There's a bunch of different reasons you might want to hire a guide, but definitely if you want to know what it's like to go fly fishing, then having a guide take you out is money well spent. And they'll pretty much show you a lot of things that you wouldn't learn on your own. Another great way, since a lot of people don't have enough money or necessarily wouldn't want to budget that much money to hire a guide, and would be to look online and find a local fly fishing club. They have a lot of mentor programs, and I know a lot of them here in California do a lot of group fishing trips too, either with or without guides. But that's another great way. They have a lot of I think a lot of clubs do a lot of rod building and fly tying, as well as have some mentorship programs. So I think definitely getting with a club is probably gonna be the best way for most people to get into the sport. And then finally, there are a bunch of instructors that you can reach out to on Fly Fishers International. They'll be able to teach you a lot of different things, but there are certified fly casting instructors, and they're the ones that are going to be the experts on teaching the basics about fly casting, which is the foundation of the sport.
And I would say from my own experience that, you know, once you kind of learn some basic casts, it's fun. It's fun to fly cast, whether you're catching it or anything or not. It's just a lot of fun.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I really love doing. A lot of times during lunch, I'll go out and take my 6-weight and my distance line and go out and practice my loops and throwing distance, double hauling, all that kind of stuff. And it's kind of like practice, like running intervals for track or hitting the weight room for whatever sport you do. The time you spend on the water, once you get to a certain point and you want to be able to catch fish and you want to be able to reach the places that you can't, if you can't cast that well, and in order to stay untangled so that when you get that chance to catch that rising 20-inch rainbow trout, definitely be able to execute the cast is something that pays off. And it makes the entire experience much more enjoyable.
Okay, well, let's talk about flies, because there's all these different kinds of flies. There's, you know, so-called dry flies, wet flies, and we don't have time to go into all of it.
Right.
But can you give us the basics of, you know, what are the differences in terms of the aquatic insects? Because you're trying to get the trout to eat something that looks like they want to normally feed on. Could you kind of give us the basics of what kind of different flies there are?
Sure. I think you touched on it right off the bat. If you're fishing for rainbow trout, and up here in Northern California, that's the native fish. And so if you're going to fish for rainbows, they have a very small brain, and it's wired to do a couple of things. And one of them is to select for something that's going to be easy for them to eat, is abundant. And so a lot of times getting them, you know, figuring out what they're going to eat right off the bat is the key to being able to actually hook them. And there's a lot of things that go into that, but it's a few concepts of figuring out the fish behavior and then what is in the stream at that time of the year or day, and then being able to match that. So do you need to have an entomology degree? No, but as long as you understand those concepts and have a pretty good grasp about what is actually in the streams in that general area, then you should have a pretty good idea. And a lot of fly shops will be able to help you out. Like right now, here's what they're eating, you know, this size, this color, and that kind of thing. And they'll help you out with rigs and everything else. And then later on, if you want to become a more accomplished fly fisher, then you're going to have to learn a little bit more about the different entomology, you know, benthic invertebrates, the caddis, the mayflies, the stoneflies, the scuds, the midges, all those kinds of things and their life cycles, and then figure out what are the most vulnerable times for those particular insects, and be able to tie on or, you know, pick the best thing to tie on the end of your line in order to catch fish. Now, I have some people that I know, they don't care. They're going to go out there, they're going to tie on a certain fly, they're going to throw it. And if they don't catch fish, they don't care. They just want to have fun. But if you want to catch fish, that's key to understanding it. And like I said, you can normally go to a fly shop in your area that you're going to fish, and they'll tell you what's working. So.
Yeah. And I imagine once you get to be at an expert level, like somebody like yourself, is you kind of become a naturalist, where you are learning all about the aquatic insects in the streams and rivers and lakes or whatever that you're fishing, the waterways. And you're learning a lot and observing a lot as you're out there about what's in the stream right now. What is it that these fish are going to be feeding on? And that seems like that would be part of the fun too.
Yeah. That's one of the aspects of fly fishing that I really enjoy, is entomology. I'm not a scientist. That's not my background. I had some science in college, but one of the things that really is intriguing to me is figuring out, what the current conditions are, and being able to predict what the fish may or may not be eating, and also looking into the future. So picking up the rocks off the bottom of the river and seeing what's on them can tell you some things, like what's living down there, but learning more about the life cycles of the insects is really kind of fun as far as I'm concerned. For example, right now we have on the upper Sacramento River up above Lake Shasta, the October caddis larvae are migrating and starting to pupate, and they're going to spend like 6 weeks to 2 months pupating and turning into the adult caddis. And so they're kind of vulnerable right now because they're drifting and getting into the shallower sections, then building their cases. And you can actually go and see them crawling around on the rocks that are in some of the shallower and clear sections of the river. And it's kind of cool. And they're the largest caddis there is in, I think, in the world. So later on, starting in October and happening all the way through November, they'll hatch. And when they're pupas, they can actually swim around underwater for a couple of days before they actually hatch, and the fish go crazy. So of course, it's a huge food source for the trout in about three different portions of their life cycle, and being able to predict that, and when they're going to be hatching as adults and laying eggs, and being able to figure out what part of the river you want to be on. That's to me is a lot of fun. And then the other thing about that is being able to figure out how to tie flies that are going to match that, and then how to fish them. And that's really kind of the advanced fly fisherman is the people that figure out, like, hey, I know in October this is going to happen. I'm going to need this size of fly, and I'm going to want to be able to fish it this way at this time of day. And that's really kind of the advanced aspect of the sport that I really enjoy.
Yeah, well, you said you were not a scientist, but I would argue that you are, because you're making observations, you're coming up with a hypothesis that, I think they're feeding on this, and then you're doing an experiment based on what you're observing, right, using a certain fly, and then if your experiment turns out to be correct and you confirm your hypothesis, you've caught a fish, so right, you are a scientist.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, that's just really super enjoyable. And that's one of the reasons why I tie flies. But there are a lot of guys that just come in and buy flies, and that's fine too. And, you can catch a ton of flies on all the patterns we have out now. So it's pretty amazing. So,
yeah. Well, let's talk about where you are in Northern California and the trout fishery there. We're in this incredible drought in the West.
Yeah.
How are the fisheries doing, in terms of the drought?
Yeah, that's a great question right now. And I would say that we had the drought that was broken by the El Nino in 2017. And the rivers, they were lower and they become warmer. So it pretty much compresses the area that the fish habitat. There's not as much volume of for them to occupy. One of the nice things about rainbow trout is they have evolved over the millennia to basically they have so many different life histories or possibilities that they can actually do as an adult fish. Because of that, they're pretty resilient. You're going to see fish die-offs due to droughts, but you're also going to see fish that migrate out to the ocean. So right now, there, I would say that the Sacramento River up above Lake Shasta is pretty low, and it is pretty warm flowing into the river. But a lot of those fish have migrated out of the lower river, either upstream or down into Lake Shasta. And so it's doing pretty well. The McLeod River right now happens to be blown below Lake McLeod because there's a glacier that that comes down through Mud Creek that let a lot of silt into the system. And so therefore the turbidity is, it's about probably 6 inches of visibility on the river right now. So those fish are probably not doing too well in terms of eating, but the water is still relatively cold, and they'll come out fine after the river clears. They'll be able to start eating again. Some of the other streams up in this area, the major streams like the Fall River and Hat Creek, are not doing too poorly. The water is still relatively cold. They are both spread out of aquifers that are sprung up from, you know, snow melt through really porous lava rock in like the Fall River Valley and up on the north east slope of Mount Lassen. So they're not doing too bad. I think probably the way rainbow trout normally their life cycle goes is they'll spend time as fingerlings and then in their natal habitat, and then they'll migrate as they get bigger down into larger bodies of water, or they'll stay and mature in the smaller bodies of water. And so because of that migration, you'll have some that are putting eggs in their one basket by staying put, and others that migrate into lower elevations, into larger bodies of water. So I think we'll be all right. Right now, what we're really worried about is going to be this winter. If we don't have a decent snowpack this winter, then that's going to cause a lot of harm in particularly the smaller watersheds. So that's where we are right now.
Well, you mentioned some places, Hat Creek, the McLeod River, Fall River. For people not familiar with this area, these rivers, these areas surrounding where you are there in Redding, California, these are some of the prime trout fishing destinations in the world, aren't they? Why is this place, you know, tell me about how special are these waters that people want to come to fish there?
Well, I think President Carter used to come out and fish on Hat Creek. It's a really famous spring creek. They used to have some really huge salmon fly, stonefly hatches below Powerhouse 2. And it's got some really nice, just really even spring creek flows. For those who don't know, a spring creek is fed by a spring. It has really super clear water, and they'll develop just amazing insect life with mayflies and caddisflies and stuff. It's pretty much world renowned, and it's really one of the prettiest little pieces of water from the Powerhouse 2 Riffle down to Lake Britton. And the McLeod River, I would say, is famous for its rainbows. It had the first national fish hatchery established there by Livingston Stone. It was named the Baird Hatchery, and it was actually produced salmon. And then when the Shasta Dam got put in, it inundated the hatchery. But the McLeod River rainbows have been exported pretty much just about every continent except for, I think, Greenland and Antarctica. And so let's see, the McLeod River is from Lake McLeod down to Lake Shasta is like one of the most beautiful spots there is up here in Northern California. So if anyone wants to come up and fish a freestone river with native rainbow trout in it, and some large browns that were introduced back in the 1880s, then that'd be a great place. The Sacramento River here in Redding happens to also be famous for a lot of different reasons, but for the trout fishermen, it's open year round and it's fed by the Lake Shasta. So it has cold water supplied by Lake Shasta and the temperature control device year round. So even in the summertime, the river's temperature is about 55 degrees here in town. That's as warm as it'll ever get. And we have a huge population of wild rainbow trout. We also have four distinct runs of salmon that come up here. And we don't fish for them here, but what that means for the river is that each one of those hen salmon comes up here and lays eggs. And so it can lay, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 pounds of eggs. And that means that the rainbows have a ton of protein coming up out of the ocean being fed to them. So that's something that most people kind of think of fishing an egg bite up in Alaska, but we do it here right in Redding. Other places, we have the Trinity and Klamath rivers with steelhead. So I can drive an hour from the shop and go over and fish for steelhead after work in September. And other rivers we have around here, there's the Fall River. That's the largest spring creek in California. It has an interesting history that you couldn't fish it until some guy went up there and started cutting fences. It was all private land. And so since you can't wait it, all the ranchers put barbed wire fences basically to keep all the other anglers from motoring up the river and fishing it. And there was a guy that went up in his canoe and just started cutting fences and fishing up there. And he got ticketed and went to court and they opened up the river. So it's a really beautiful spring creek.
Wow. So bottom line is you are surrounded by some of the greatest trout fishing in the world.
Yeah. And within an hour, you can get to so much water. I don't know how many miles there is. Mike Michalak, the owner, has a bunch of different numbers there. But in truth, if you want to drive an hour, you can find a place to fish year-round up here.
Yeah. Well, we're about out of time. But before we let you go, briefly, what's your favorite thing about your work there at the Fly Shop in Redding, California?
What I would say is my favorite thing is teaching at our schools. We have some fly fishing schools and they teach a lot of different stuff, but getting with people and teaching them how to cast, how to tie knots and rig, and teaching them and allowing them to see how accessible it really is, that's probably the most gratifying thing. And then helping people catch their first fish, that's, seeing a smile on their face, that's the best. But the other thing is I also talk to all our guides on a daily basis. And so I know exactly where I want to go when the weekend comes up.
You got the inside information.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. All right. Well, thanks so much, Brian.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks to our guests, Curtis Knight, the executive director of CalTrout, Christian Rivard from Trout Unlimited in Oregon, and Brian Quick from the Fly Shop in Redding, California. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. Check out past episodes at mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to Blue Dot on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. We're produced and engineered by the maestro, Matt Fidler. I'm Dave Schlo, and for all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.